The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome back out to everyone to the Exchange Live. My name is Paul Hill. I'm delighted again to be able to speak to accomplished UK small and mid-cap fund manager Judith McKenzie of Downing. So welcome, Judith.
Good to see you, Paul. How you doing?
Yeah, very good. It's fantastic to have you back on the show. Got lots of cross currents in the markets. On the positive side, we do seem to have tamed inflation. Interest rates are coming down. We've got real incomes climbing, and the UK stock valuations are still pretty attractive. But on the other side of the coin, the other side of the ledger, we have the ongoing, unfortunately, wars in the Middle East, which is escalating, and in Ukraine. Plus, obviously, the impending UK budget and the US presidential elections. But before sort of like getting your view of the markets and how you see things going forward, I don't suppose you could just quickly remind the audience what kind of stocks you like, what kind of investor you are.
Yeah, of course. So as you probably know, I've been investing in UK small caps for about 25 years and was a sell side analyst before that. So I've got the scars. I've been through the ups and downs. And I think our philosophy has kind of been honed by some of the good and the bad and the ugly of those 25 years plus. And I think if you want to identify a style and put us in a bucket, we're value investors. But what does that mean? Because everybody says, or many people say, that they're value investors. But what we're trying to do is we're ignoring the price on the screen. We're looking at the intrinsic value of the underlying business. And in doing that, we're looking at how the company can generate returns on invested capital. So we're looking at relatively high returns on invested capital. And by doing that, you're typically getting companies that can throw off real cash. So we're not fixated with accounting earnings. Is really much more about cash. So when we're looking at these businesses, you obviously don't want to fall into value traps. And so therefore you're looking at a catalyst as well, layered on top of the good return on invested capital and cash flows. So that catalyst can be a number of things. It can be earnings progression that might not be in the market. It could be some kind of corporate catalyst or self-help. And we'll talk about that quite a bit, no doubt, as we go through some of the companies. And so once we've done that, especially at the moment, we're putting companies into three buckets. The earnings compounders, and that might be helped with some secular growth. And those are companies like Ashtead, OneSpatial, Cohort, balance sheet leaders. So the ones that hopefully let you sleep at night, things like H&T. And then we've got that self-help bucket that we talked about as well. So that means that the company can pull its own levers. And that really is quite helpful in this kind of environment where they have been bounced around a bit by macro. And also where if you've got self-help, you're not really dependent on the market revaluing something. So really just trying to look at it in that way. And I was actually just looking at some of the numbers that you churned out before this, yeah. And we've got some PE ratios, anything from 5.5 times right up to 38 times. And that seems weird to say for a value investor. So I'm almost contradicting myself, but hopefully as we go through some of the companies, you'll see why we actually think they're good value, because maybe the numbers aren't quite in the market, or they've got great RRR and ARR, and some of those dynamics that can justify hopefully the valuations that we might be talking about.
Yeah. And which one of those three buckets is the GARP shares in it? Because obviously the growth at a reasonable price, ones which are basically, they may optically look high on a PE ratio, but on PEG ratio or on your longer term view, 3 to 5 years, there's going to be significant upside on the intrinsic worth compared to what the current share price is.
Yeah, I would put them in the compounders bucket. Okay. I mean, it just actually depends, because Nick, my colleague, and I do tend to argue over which buckets they go in sometimes. I mean, Avingtrans, for instance, I might say it's got so much self-help around it because there's corporate activity, whereas he sees that as a value compounder. So, there's a little bit of a grey area sometimes.
Yeah, well, they sometimes fit in both buckets, don't they?
Which is exactly. And then sometimes they're value compounders and then the profit warning, they go into the self-help. So you should get that as well.
True. And just more broadly then, what's your sort of outlook for sort of small and mid caps? Because obviously we've got a few sort of like Damocles swords in the terms of what's been expected, or worst case for the budget, for instance, and the, obviously with the US presidential election is more sort of bigger macro. But let's just look at what sort of like short-term and longer-term view do you think with small caps? Because valuations have been really beaten down.
Yeah, you know, it depends on the day that I wake up at the moment, to be honest, because just going back to what you said at the very start, if you look at the macro, and we're not led by macro, but we couldn't help but be led by macro over the last couple of years. You know, the inflation, the interest rate environment has really improved. So I feel really positive on that side, and our companies are reacting positively to that, and they're investing in their own businesses. So that's fine. And then you've got the geopolitical situation, and I think that has probably been underestimated, and that in certain ways could blow up very negatively just for UK markets or generally for markets. But that's not something that we can control. The one thing that's the big elephant in the room for me at the moment is the budget. We run inheritance tax monies, and clearly that's something that we're concerned about. But you know, more importantly, we don't just run IHT monies, we run small cap and mid cap monies. And we've seen that even just the threat of it has had a disproportionate effect on the market over the last 5-6 weeks or so. I do think it would have a terrible effect in the market if BR reliefs were withdrawn for AIM companies. But I also think from an economic point of view, it'll be a complete disaster when it comes to that growth agenda that Rachel Reeves has got. In some days I'm slightly depressed about the prospect of that, but the reality is that there is so much damage that would be done, and I'm confident that this government is on receive and they really are pushing that growth agenda. And I tell you, if on the 30th of October that BR is not touched, this market is going to turn, because you've got the positive dynamics of companies being cheaper than they probably have been at any point in my career. You've got still got some M&A kind of circling as well. You've got pension funds reforming and beginning to look at this area of the market. We're speaking to a couple of pension LGPS pension funds that are interested in investing in AIM companies. You only need the demand element to shift a little bit, and this market will take off. So in some ways, I'm short-term negative because of all the clouds about, but I do think we're going to see the other end of it. And yeah, I'm pretty positive, actually, especially if BR reliefs are not touched.
That's a great positive note there. I mean, I was actually at the front page of the FT today. You had sort of like an article saying that Rachel Reeves was going to withdraw some of her more zealous tax raising measures, want to go with the non-DOMs, because she's realizes actually it's going to be NPV negative. Either they'll raise less taxes than they actually lose in national income. So I suspect that'll be the same. And also, I think what you've got is if they do normalize, which is probably the case, of CGT capital gains with income tax, I think quite a few people have actually been selling ahead of it, front running it, so the winners have been sold off. So I'm with you. I actually suspect on the balance of probabilities there's some good bargains before the announcement on the 30th, and then it could all be game on.
Yeah, and look, the one thing I've learned is it's stupid to try and time the markets and beat politics. So you know, just look at the fundamentals, look at where the prices are at the moment. If the market's off 5 or 6%, take the benefit of it. Now, these are good companies.
Yeah, good. Okay, fantastic. Well, if anybody wants to ask Judith questions, please put them in the chat. But we've got plenty, so I'm going to get through those as we go through. Let's kick off, though, with one company that's been a perennial performer for you guys, because I've spoken about three, is Eagle Eye, which is basically the UK's number one software developer for promotions and sort of like personalized coupons and offers to largely the supermarkets, actually. I think it does something for Tesco's, it does it for Asda and Morrison's, but lots of other people who want to have personalized. What's your sort of your latest view on this one? Because it's done very well over the long term.
Yeah, you know, I think it's really just kind of started on its journey. And just to remind folks, so Tim Mason, the CEO, he used to be CMO and CEO of Tesco back in the day. And if you remember, Tesco was the first kind of pioneer of loyalty cards. I'm quite sure everybody's had a Tesco loyalty card at some point in their life. And Sir Terry Leahy was Tim's boss. And Terry owns, I think, 8% of Eagle Eye. So the pedigree of what you've got here is pretty good. You know, you can't really dispute that. And I think for me, I'm actually catching up with them this afternoon, so I'll probably know more after that. But for me, the real benefit will come from the cross-sell. So you've now got new AI tools that have crept into this solution. And they've got a great customer base already. So the more that they can sell down that pipe, then the forecast, well, just makes a mockery of the forecast, really. Mm. So this is one for me that, although it's probably one of the most expensive things in our portfolio, I see that the forecasts are quite prudent at the moment. And I see that the opportunity that can come from not just the supermarkets. So at the moment, the supermarkets are getting a 7x return for using Eagle Eye. Because the payback is in multiples, around about 7x. But that's mainly because of the frequency of the return customer and the increased basket size. Now, you take that into other markets, not just grocery, then you can really demonstrate that ROI. So I think they've gone from being probably a sort of relatively early stage tech company to now having proven their market position and that ROI argument. And they're now taking that into other markets. So about 76% of revenue at the moment is in grocery. But I think as we see that shift, that will definitely benefit as well. And, you know, the numbers are nice. The ARR is up 19%. And I think we're looking for earnings growth of about 20-odd% coming through as well. Mm. It is worth pointing out, though, so things look okay at the kind of EBITDA line. You get down to the reported profit line and it doesn't look so pretty. That's because they are capitalizing quite a lot of the cost, so it's still in its growth phase. And I think for me, when I chat to them this afternoon, it's really trying to understand when that operational gearing really starts to flow through, because I really want to see it being, we've got 97% gross margins here, you really want to see the cash flow coming through as well. So that's the one question I probably got for them this afternoon.
Yeah. When you talk about valuation, though, I mean, yes, it may look expensive on the sort of like, the PE level at sort of 21x. But when you look at it on a revenue basis and EV sales, it's only on less than 2.3, which for a software business is pretty slim. And the reason why it seems expensive at the PE is because its EBIT margin is only 10%, whereas it should be 20% for a software in the fullness of time with that operational gearing. So they must have quite a lot of self-help measures, I guess, they can do.
Yes, yeah, I think so. And their growth has come through their investment and development, so that it's worked, and they've proven it works. Their market position's good. So yeah, there's a lot to like here.
Yeah. Okay, good. Well, let's switch gears to another one in the software sector, which has been a perennial performer for you, is One Spatial, which is a sort of leader in location-based data sort of management systems, but has now sort of like developed just recently and launched two very interesting apps, one in the UK, one Streetworks, and then another one in an emergency services out in the States. And I was lucky enough at a dinner last week that you were the head of to sit next to the CEO of One Spatial, and she was telling me about One Streetworks, and it certainly does have a lot of opportunity. But as a shareholder in the business, what's your, sort of your thoughts?
Well, I deliberately planked Claire next to you last week so you could
wax lyrical about
how good this little business is. Again, it's not one that's not desperately cheap, but we're looking at growth of over or nearly 50% in EPS coming through next year. And actually, if you look at the valuation that IQGeo went for, that looks desperately cheap compared to it. So, and actually, I would argue this is a better quality business. And you've mentioned a couple of the apps there. So One Streetworks, it's worth going on to the website. It's really pretty cool. So it creates a compliant traffic management plan in about 2 minutes. And obviously for local councils and whatever, that's a great accolade. And there are some little crossovers with Traxys there in terms of that traffic management, data management side of things. But I think their contract wins have been good. I think they've had 5 contract wins since the start of this year. And some of these really sort of highlight the USP that this company has got. It's managing multiple data sets. There's a French contract, I think, with the National Public Organization, can't quite remember the name of it, but that's basically validating millions of data points and location data points across 3,500 agencies nationwide. And then you've got other contracts like they do the same for National Underground in the UK. They work with Google, must be good, and the Californian State of Transport. So, and they say that each one of the states in the US could be $1 million contract or more, and they're pretty much getting into all of the states. So you can see where the growth's coming from. But again, I think they're quite prudent on their forecasting. It's got a nice tight shareholder list as well. I think you've got some big guys there. You've got Ted Needle and Marlboro also in alongside us. And we've now got 4%, and it's a company that, you know, we continue to buy, actually.
Yeah, and I think there's a recent softness in the price. It's just solely, actually, people front-running what they think is going to be the CTG tax. You've got people who are long-term holders, not the professionals, but retail. And because it, you know, the liquidity in AIM stocks in general have just pushed it down. So if anything, that shouts to me as a buying opportunity. But hey, people have to make their own conclusions. Yeah. Okay, yeah. We've got a couple of questions just to quickly go through. We've got SC81, and he's asking about, first of all, Argentex, and the next one was EKF Diagnostics. I don't know whether you want to just quickly perhaps take the EKF first, because I know I think you still own it, don't you?
No, we don't actually. We don't own it anymore. Rosemary, my colleague, still owns it, I believe.
Yeah.
So we, rightly or wrongly, we came out of EKF when we felt that the fermentation side of the business in the US was going to take longer than maybe we'd anticipated. And that is borne out to a certain extent. It's one that we keep an eye on. I think, you know, the core business in the UK, it's nearly double digit growth. Mm. It's a nice business. You could probably argue that the two businesses shouldn't necessarily be together over the longer term. But for us, it just felt like too long a wait on the fermentation side. And I think what's happened is they've managed to get some of the formulations working in relatively sort of low scale, but not managed to upscale it yet. So I think we want to see signs of that being able to upscale before we can attribute much value to the US business. But and on the contrary to that, you could also argue that the UK business is easily worth the market cap of the company. So, we keep an eye on it. Argentex, I kind of lost track on. I'm not really. We sold out of it, so we've not really, followed it much since then.
Yeah. Okay. Good. All right. Okay. Well, let's continue with the software. We've got Traxys, which is probably the UK sort of poster child for software and sort of tech services into network rail. Does sort of ticketing, also does maintenance on lines and lot and scheduling software, and is trying to then lift and shift that pretty unique software out into the States, where they really do need help. Even we think British Rail needs help, but they really need that Amtrak out in the States on their upgradings. What's your sort of your latest on this? Shares have recently been quite weak. They had a profit warning heading into just in the general election, because I think it coincided with their year end, and it meant that they had a deferral or delay of certain orders from Network Rail and some. But they came out then with a sort of reassuring statement. The shares have just again sold off this week. But what's sort of your latest on Traxys?
Yeah, I mean, I think the share price tells you everything, doesn't it? It's gone from what 900p to 600p over the course of the summer, hasn't it?
Yeah.
I've held this stock for 13 years, and I probably had about 26 upgrades in the time. And I think what's annoyed me slightly, as you can tell, I'm a bit vexed by it.
Yeah.
What's annoyed me slightly is that, you know, it had a premium rating. It had a premium rating because it was consistently capable of meeting forecasts. And they seem to have a good degree of visibility. And of what annoys me about the reason for the profit warning in the summer is that, you know, they blame the snap election. We knew an election was coming at some point. And you wouldn't really, if you're a business, I don't think you'd take a bet as to whether it was going to happen in July or October or November. So it was unfortunate, because you're right, it happened just at their year end. And I think what maybe the market, what we didn't understand, was that when an election is called, that the train operating companies, Network Rail, they just down tools. They stop any kind of spend. And it was just at the time of their literally bridging their full year results. So I've got a degree of sympathy there. a degree, not a massive
skepticism,
amount.
It sounds though.
Yeah. It's maybe sounds a lot. And then, so that accounted, I think, for, there was a £5 million headwind that they had on the profits warning. So that accounted for, I think, 2 million or either 3 million or the five. The other part was actually £2 million in the Americas that was dented. Now, they bought this American business, get my timing right, probably about 3 or 4 years ago. And I think the reality is that it's a good business, but they probably, and shareholders probably didn't understand quite what it was and where the benefit would come from. I think we were all thinking it was going to come from the MPEC side of the business, which is condition monitoring equipment. And actually, it's probably a little bit different. They also had exposure to yard automation in the US. And that's where the black hole has come from in the US. That business turns out not to be as quality as the rest of Traxys' businesses. And they're actually reselling some kit into that yard automation side. And that accounts for about $10 million worth of revenue. So in the latest statement that's come, just came out, you could see that they, I think they said something along the lines of, we're going to be focusing on our quality, high margin business. And what that meant is that they're going to be ditching the yard automation side. I think that's good in the longer term, but a dent in the shorter term. Mm-hmm. And I think I'm a little bit disappointed because I think they could have known a bit more about the sensitivity of that yard automation business, and also maybe messaged a little bit clearer to the market that the pipeline in the US was great, but it was probably going to be quite lumpy. And a few of the contracts there have been delayed. Now, as you say, subsequently, they come out with a really strong trading statement. And so therefore, pretty hopeful of meeting that full year number. The 2025 forecasts have been tweaked modestly, because they hadn't been tweaked previously, and they needed a 60% upgrade from 24 to 25 to meet that 25 number. And they've never done 60% earnings growth. So it looked like a jump too far. So I think for us, and the clear message to management and to the chair has been, look, you've got a great business. We love your exposure to network rail and transport infrastructure, but just consolidate a little bit. Don't do any acquisitions. We know you've got cash in the balance sheet, but just deliver on these numbers and you might get back to a premium rating that you did before.
Yeah.
But you need to deliver on these numbers. But now, actually, if you look at it today, I think it's on about 14 times PE, and you're getting some really good quality earnings coming through. So, and you've got the US business, which is, although I've been quite damning about it just now, actually the contracts that are coming through on the dispatch side are really interesting. These are big contracts, $8 to $10 million contracts. So there's a lot to like about it, but just consolidate, deliver on earnings, and I think shareholders will be happy with that.
Yeah. Do you know who they compete against? Is it like sort of the Siemens of this world and sort of like in their technology division? I mean, there doesn't seem to be a massive, big global competitor.
Not really. Yeah. There's not a global competitor. There are some smaller, I think there's a German operator that kind of in the condition monitoring space, but they've got market, I'm not saying market control, but that's the wrong way of putting it, but they've certainly got a dominant market position.
Yeah. Okay, good. Well, let's stay in the tech sector. We've got Phonics, which came out with results, I think, yesterday or 2 days ago. Basically, good, solid numbers. And now they seem to have a growth strategy. They do sort of like mobile payments and messaging for sort of charities, but also for things like the Eurovision Song Contest and Laocoon. They've got a big position in the UK, building it in Ireland. And they've also got another one now, apparently. So do you want to take us through how you look, your view, sort of like Phonics?
Yeah, well, I mean, the numbers look lovely. So it's a really light OPEX, CAPEX model. So I think there's only 4 million of OPEX. Yeah. Free cash flow is pretty strong at over 15 million, I think. Got unutilized cash of over 10. Really nice business. They've only got 50 people. And I hadn't probably, when we caught up with them last week, I hadn't really realized how light that OPEX requirement is. So therefore, everything really is coming back through to cash. So the numbers look good. And then when you look at the markets, again, I probably hadn't, when I looked at this company at first, I hadn't realized that the UK market in this space is the most mature of any of the developed world, really. So we're more than happy to send a text message and sign up to £2 for a ticket to enter a 100 grand or 200 grand prize draw. You know, that it's all over interactive TV and it's all over radio, etc. So it's quite a mature market. It's very well regulated. It was pretty badly regulated at the start, but Ofcom jumped in and really took the regulation that was in the gambling world into this world. So yeah, they've got a dominant market position, work for most of the broadcasters in the UK, and the model's really good because the broadcasters make a ton load of cash out of it. They make money out of it, obviously, and it tends to increase audience views, and therefore it's good for companies like ITV. So I'm quite sure you don't watch Loose Women and This Morning, but you know those.
That's a good guess.
Those programs do tend to be quite driven by this interactive TV and, you know, texting things through. So the ticket price typically used to be £2, and that's now moved to £2.50. So that's a nice little dynamic. But also they're moving into Portugal. And they've got a couple of relationships there already. So one is with Bauer, the radio giant, who they already work with in the UK. And you can see that it won't happen overnight, but you can see that this could quite easily be a bit like Ireland and move into sort of 2 to 3 million worth of revenues at great margin. And that's not really in the forecast. So yeah, we quite like this business. And it's got the right kind of growth dynamics. There's quite good barriers to entry. There's smaller players, and what a cracking way of incentivizing or thinking about incentivizing a CEO. So I really respect this board, actually, and respect the CEO because of it. He gets, I think, a base salary of 170 grand, no bonus, and his incentive purely comes from his equity. He owns 6% of the equity, which he bought himself, and there's no other incentive round about it. And he says that his incentive is to get the share price moving. No fluffy options or nil-priced options. It's purely on his equity that he owns. And I think because of that, they are probably one of the most receptive when it comes to shareholder communications. I think they're pretty good at shareholder comms. He really does want to let you know what his business does and how good it is. So, yeah, he's not, no snouts in the trough here.
Yeah.
It's good, isn't it?
It is, yeah. I think the only time I've ever seen that is Elon Musk when he's, but he took $50 billion out.
Yeah.
Slightly different level.
It's slightly different level, yeah.
What's quite interesting as well, all these stocks, the first ones we've talked about, you know, they're all quality businesses, software, high gross margins, operating leverage. In September, their share prices, every single one of them has dropped off, which is really interesting, which chimes perfectly with what you talked about and identified, that we could actually get a bit, if there's nothing major of a problem on the 30th of October, actually you could see a big bounce here.
Yeah, I mean, it's crazy, isn't it? You know, I was speaking this morning on our UK equities team call, and Rosemary had been off on holiday for 2.5 weeks. And I said to her, you know, I've had some great results. And she said, but it doesn't matter. My valuations are down about 8%. And, you know, that's kind of the way we're feeling at the moment. You're getting good results, like people like Phoenix coming out with decent results. And next thing, your share price is flat or down. Quite depressing.
There's always one exception to the rule if it's an absolute storming business. And again, you've spoken about this one for some time. Cohort, which is obviously in the UK defence sector, does a lot of sort of electronic warfare, does training as well for the UK military. The shares have just been a thoroughbred over the last 3 or 4 years. But I suppose the question comes now, do you ever sell these stocks? Because they've treated you so well.
I suppose we would. We have taken profits in things like Traxys over the years, and Phoenix is relatively new to us. So yeah, of course, Cohort, I think I first invested when it IPO'd, when Nick Priest, who I think
the tank man.
Yeah, Mr. Tankman. When he was around. So yes, we have sold over the years, and I think you sell when you've got some relatively obvious headwinds, but you know, we've had an upgrade on Cohort. We had an upgrade on the upgrade this week, didn't we, on the AGM?
Yes.
Or maybe it was last week. So we had, an upgrade on the June upgrade. And the order book is now over 500 million.
Yeah, 575.
Were good.
The order book was up another 10% just from the previous year,
and
from March.
You've got...
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's been really strong, and you've got 95 or maybe more than that of the order book covered for 2024 and 2025. So I don't really want to be selling it. And, you know, you've got some real benefit coming through from those long-term contracts. So, and customers are folk like government who tend to be relatively good at paying. And, you know, we've just talked about some of the geopolitical issues at the moment in the world. So, but even without that, I think defence spend is going to be on the agenda. Well, it is on the agenda, isn't it? So, no, this is a buy and hold for sure.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. If you've got a really good sort of thoroughbred, you just stay on the horse, don't you, and just keep going. It might go up, it may go down, but overall the direction of travel has been up. And particularly when you've got such a good quality management team who have got such status across that industry, haven't they? Because all of them are well known within the MOD and US military.
That's right. Good team, really good team.
Yeah. Okay, good. We've got a question from Ben Sharman. He's basically asking, if you've had a 35-year, it must be quite an easy one. But he says basically, two of the sort of the biggest mistakes you've made over the past out of your career investing and what you learned from it. But just quickly, I've had plenty of myself, but
I've got tons, sadly. I suppose the two that stick out, one of my earlier ones, and it sounds so obvious now, it was a company called China Foods. Guess what? It was in China.
Yeah.
And it sold foods, and it was a soy sauce manufacturer, so probably the third largest soy sauce manufacturer in China, you know. And it was a team that had gone in, I think, from Heinz. Cracking management team, so a European management team going into Chinese business and growth in premium soy sauces. I mean, I think the PE was 3x when we went in. I think what I didn't understand was China. Quite frankly. Yeah. And I think at that point I realized no matter what, even with a management team that you was living in the ground and you know where we were doing diligence out there as well, we just didn't understand the banking systems, the politics, the backhanders that went on at that time. This is going back 10-12 years. So that's
the ethics, wasn't it?
And that for me was one where I thought, just don't invest in territories you don't understand, cultures you don't understand. And markets that are too far away from you. So that was that one. I think the other one for me that was really disappointing, and it does tie back into one of the companies that we're going to talk about today, and that is Redhall.
Yes.
And Redhall owned Booths. Booths is now part of Avingtrans. And only just thinking about it, how it links back into some of the companies that we hold now. And sadly, Redhall got itself caught up in contracts that were quite onerous. And where the payment terms weren't attractive, and they didn't have the power and the ability at that time to be able to renegotiate those contracts. Actually, when Booths ended up getting sold out of administration of Redhall to Avingtrans, and that's exactly what Avingtrans did. They renegotiated all the contracts with the likes of Sellafield and some of the big providers at that time. So that was frustrating because you could see the value that was there, but it was in a business that was too caught up with a balance sheet that was snarled up and HMRC being at its back. So, you know, the danger of contracting companies, I think, was something that I learned out of that. And I'm not saying I would never do a contracting company, but I'm certainly making sure that we test the integrity of the contracts that are there. A couple of those contracts were trophy contracts that the management team felt that they had to get to wave the flag to get the share price to go up. And that's the wrong type of behaviour in these types of companies. So thanks for that. It's been rather cathartic.
Well, you're not the only one. I mean, we've basically got, we had ISG on the contractor side, which is the sixth biggest contractor, went bust only 6 or 7 days ago. And they still haven't seen the sort of the little earthquakes going off across that industry. So there is dangers in there. And then even the best of people lose money in China. Because I remember there was a rock star large cap fund manager. I think it was Anthony Bolton who did a Chinese special situations. And it was a special situation by the end when he left because it had real problems. But yeah, I think it's clear if you're investing in particularly overseas businesses, then it's very difficult to get close to those companies and the due diligence and actually sort of what's happening. But okay, great. Well, let's move on to Avingtrans, which is basically one of the UK's sort of like, it's a niche engineering business. They've got this pie strategy, they call it pinpoint invest exit. They've got a big position in nuclear, in defense, in energy, and also building up in medical, came out with some pretty strong results this week and upgraded actually on their engineering business. Do you want to take us through your latest views on this? Because at least now, if you did sell, unfortunately, Redhall to them, at least now making money, some back anyway, on the shares because they've done well.
It does the full cycle, doesn't it? I think you interviewed Stephen and Steve earlier on in the week, so I'm going to use some of your sound bites from that, actually.
Yes, please do.
Mainly because I think we were probably looking at it in sort of the same way. So it's some of the parts, really, isn't it, here? And you've got the healthcare side that's slightly more embryonic, well, much more embryonic than the AES business. And as you say, the whole Hayward Tyler business and Booths, etc., seems to be going very, very well. In fact, really bullish about that. And you can even see within that business where you can probably rely some value. And I think what was quite interesting from your chat with them earlier in the week was that they were saying that, yeah, Booths is not necessarily ready for sale at the moment, probably needs a little bit more investment, but they were definitely talking about Hayward Tyler and the assets that are sitting there. So I began thinking about, what might be coming first in terms of an exit? And it's maybe something along those lines. They've got that, how many acre site? Is it 8,000 acre site just by Luton?
I think it's worth about 10-11 million, but it's mainly exactly. the Hayward Tyler. Well, yeah, they came out with quite a big number. It had three figures involved and it ends in a million, so
and you can see that being worth the AES business could be worth what, 300p a share?
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
So and then you've got Booths in there. Even when we were looking at it, when it was in its heyday with us, we were saying, because the contracts there are with nuclear, with Sellafield, and they've invested about £4 million, but the pipeline there is now better than it's ever been. And we were thinking when we had it, that it was probably worth about £25 to £35 million. So you've got, 90 odd million, and then you've got maybe another 15, 20 for Booths. So that bit kind of pays for the way I think about it, kind of pays for the medical side. I'm unlucky enough, my husband would say, to have horses, and we get lameness all the time. And one of the things that a vet does when they come out to test for lameness is they do something called a nerve block. So they literally put they anaesthetize each part of the leg, and it's only when they do that they can pinpoint an area where the lameness might be occurring. It's pretty traumatic for the horse, pretty traumatic for the owner, because they have to pay for it. And actually being able to get some technology, pretty much identical to Adaptix. And in fact, I've seen the Adaptix working in the field. It really allows you to hone on the horse where the lameness is. So that's both a cost saving, but also saves quite a lot of trauma for lameness diagnosis. So I can see where that Adaptix business can... And we're pretty close to it now anyway. It's already been used in animals, but also now going through trials for humans. So I think it's difficult to put a valuation on the two healthcare businesses, but I know the areas that they're in and where they are in the stage of development that, you can certainly see that there's another few hundred pence within that side of the business as well. So now, it's not close. I think that's maybe 2 or 3 years away. And I think the challenge that they've got is that they might end up selling off one of their AES businesses. And then they've got a healthcare business that's loss making. And as we've seen with the working cap, quite a lot of the working cap was put into the healthcare side this year. And you've had a little bit going into the new business that they bought in the AES side. So there could just be a bit of hiatus as to where the earnings are coming from. And I think they're very good at communicating with the market, and it really is just going to be a case of reiterating the value within the core EES business, and at the same time highlighting the opportunity and getting news flow on the healthcare side. So we really like it. It's a business that will continue to hold, I think, and continue to buy for quite some time yet. Two Steve and Stephen are really good at value realization.
Yeah, as unfortunately you found out to the other side of the negotiation
table.
Yes, they are.
I think
you're right in terms of we'll get some value catalyst in with the proceeds on the engineering side, potentially very large as well. And I've got a sneak suspicion that they could spin off the healthcare or even sell it, to basically allow somebody who's got closer alignment to the end user and the hospital, not the hospital, the healthcare centers and stuff, to manage that and to take it. So that will be another value potential catalyst, which is good. Okay, we've got another question from S. Reaney. He's asking about whether you still have a stake in Equals, which is in this perennial position of a strategic review process. I think it's got its next put up or shut up, I think, is next Wednesday at 5 o'clock. I only know this because I'm a shareholder of it as well, so I'd be interested. But the business had came out with its interim results in September, absolutely storming, did 30% top line growth, and I think it was 60% increase in EBITDA, generates lots of cash. In fact, it's now, I think it's just gone ex-dividend, just paid a dividend out. Management team seem to be doing very well. But what's your sort of latest view on the sort of like the outcomes of the business and in terms of, you know, how you see it going forward?
Yeah, you know, the price that's been mooted obviously is what is 135, I think.
Yeah, that's correct.
Which doesn't get me jumping up and down and excited, unfortunately. And you know, if you take that valuation on the numbers, as you say, that came out. So it's, I think it's about 9x or thereabouts cash profit EV. And then you look at the 2025 numbers, it's on about 8x. That doesn't seem, for this quality of business, that doesn't seem overly great. But, you know, I quite like strategic reviews. It's always quite healthy to have it, I think. But this has gone on for nearly a year. Yeah. And it's cost over, I think it's 1.2 million it's cost. Mm. And I think my concern here is if it doesn't go, hopefully not at the 135 price, but if it doesn't go, then you've got a business that's had the sword of Damocles hanging over it for the last year. And Ian's a really good operator, and I think he's got an excellent team. But I think having seen businesses that are kind of up for sale and in this horrible period where nobody really knows what's happening, it does damage to the business.
Yeah.
So I think the results have been, as you say, they've kind of knocked it out of the park in terms of the numbers. But I am slightly concerned that if it's not sold, then you might just have a bit of an interim period where you could have a little bit of discord and slowdown in some of the management. I'm saying that, I think Ian, as I say, is a great entrepreneur. He's good at keeping people motivated. He clearly has to deliver these numbers. It's, you know, sadly, it's a business that I'd quite like to own for the next 5 years. But we'll know next Wednesday.
Yeah. Okay, good. Well, let's move to another one which has done pretty well over the last year or so, run by another rock star CEO. We've got HVivo, which does a sort of like human trials. It's a contract research organization, but as I say, they've just built this big facility, I think, in down the Docklands or in London anyway, to be able to do more, to expand capacity. But they're doing more sort of contract research for services as well for other pharmaceuticals and stuff. How are you playing sort of HVivo at the moment? Because it's got a long-term story, and obviously the management team seems super committed.
Yeah, I think you interviewed Mo as well, didn't you?
No, I haven't interviewed him, but I've watched some of them, and the guy is absolutely a force of nature.
Yeah, he's good. Really solid. Yeah. So here, I mean, it's pretty simple. So it's all about volume, or sales, number of beds, and recruitment. So I think they've got the beds, because as you say, they've got a Canary Wharf facility now, 50 beds. They're really good at recruitment. They used to pay quite a lot to get people to sign up to these things. Mm-hmm. And just for viewers, so what they're doing is they're getting typically students to sign up to these human trials to come in and get injected with flu over 2 weeks. Really nice accommodation, actually. They probably get paid about $3,000. Get fed well, fed and watered. And they then take these are human trials that then get taken off for, I mean, obviously in COVID, this is what helped accelerate some of the vaccine rollout as well. So, but this is not about COVID. This is actually quite a suite of antibodies and trials that they run. So the way I see it, they've ticked off the bed bit, and I think there's efficiencies coming through here. Mm. Ticked off recruitment, it's not really costing them anymore. They've got 300,000-400,000 people that they have got a pool to go and recruit from. It's about the volume and it's about the sales bit. And, you know, your big pharma are quite good at planning trials and then cancelling them. Mm. So the way I look at it, they've got 70 million of signed and paid for non-refundable contracts. The typical size of the contract is about £7 to £8 million. And it's about trying to time when they're going to land. So they actually, it's a bit like an airplane. They double book sometimes, they double park to make sure they've got the most yeah. occupancy at any point in time. So they can be quite lumpy. That's my only caution here. And they tend to get one big call off a year. So therefore, they then might have to go back to another pharma company who might be in for the next quarter and say, do you want to accelerate it? But then you've got to get recruitment and everything else lined up as well. So you've got lumpiness on lumpiness to a certain extent. Yeah. I think it's a great quality business, but just be aware of that. So you've got £70 million pipeline, and then behind that, you've got another £40 million of opportunities that they don't really know when they're going to close. And just yeah. to give you an idea as to how kind of quirky this sector is, last year they had a client come in and they really wanted a trial to be run. So I think they probably, and the numbers are not in the public domain, I've kind of worked this back, but I think they probably paid hVIVO about £10 million. And then they cancelled it and it wasn't wow. refundable. Yeah, so they ended up getting £10 million, which went around about £10 million, which then I think went into the Canary Wharf facility to help fund it. So you do need to just maybe look at margin and try and understand some of these dynamics, because you might get periods when it's quite flattered. Mm. But I, you know, it's a great business. And I think that this, the area of human trials is still in its infancy. It's not at that kind of tilting point yet where it's going to take over from normal field trials, but they're definitely, you read some of the headlines and industry papers, it's definitely a direction of travel. And these guys are, they've got the biggest facilities and capability worldwide, really. So, and it's well run, as you say.
Yeah. Well, they must have something. If a big partner is, it gives them 10 million quid for receiving no services, that just shows that their negotiating position on the contracts must be very good. So they wouldn't be cut, you know, just. Yeah, it must be pretty good. And I wouldn't be surprised also if that is the case, then, you know, one of the contract research organizations have a good look at these guys, because it's a perfect fit for them to build out their sort of like total end-to-end services, I guess. But
hey. Absolutely. You know, it's got £42 million of cash. It's 190 million of market cap, I think, PE of 17. So we came about this because we don't really have much exposure to the healthcare sector. We had EKF, which we sold down for the reasons that we talked about, but we don't really have any sort of direct healthcare exposure. And just looking at it on a PE basis, I think it's on about 16 times at the moment, 16, 17 times. Yeah. It was on a massive discount to the larger CROs, as you say. So, yeah. And it's got a return on capital of 25%, 26%. So it's nice.
Yeah. Good. Okay, good. We've got another question coming from, I've pronounced his name, Riffs off. So I think he's, he's asking about U Group, which I think basically is an engineering supplier, isn't it, for the B2B sector? I don't know exactly, but have you got any thoughts on this one? Do you own it at all, Judith? No,
I'm sorry. I can't help on that one, I don't think.
No, can I? Okay, good. Well, let's move quickly on then. We've got H&T. One which you, that.
No, sorry.
I must have hit the wrong number. We've got a wrong button. We've got H&T, which is the UK's largest pawnbroker. And this one is at a really low valuation. It's about 7.5 times PE, trades below net tangible assets. Even though obviously it's sort of like a difficult environment for people who need sort of like, you know, short-term loans and stuff. And so it's good for them. Can you give us your sort of the thesis on this one? Because you'd think it'd be doing very well, and the stock actually is not surprisingly underperformed.
Yeah, I think for a reason. So I think you're right. You know, the numbers look good. It's on very modest PE, over I think 15 times return on capital.
Yeah,
pawnbroking in this market, you know, you should be striking out the gold price where it is. So, you know, we're probably buying this as a bit of a hedge on or an option in the gold price. I am frustrated with the management team here because they delivered record earnings this year, but they had a profits, well, they wouldn't say it's a profits downgrade, but it was a profit downgrade in the summer. And that was on the, well, so what basically happened was they put out, or the analyst put out a note on the back of increased minimum wage. And that pulled their numbers down by about 10-12%. The management team said that wasn't a profits warning. It is. That's a profits warning, my book. So that kind of lost credibility. The share price came back by about 25-30% on that, I think. It came back a fair bit. So that that was the first kind of strike that wasn't brilliant. And then after that, they delivered these record earnings. But so the share price just got back to where they were before that profit adjustment. They came, I think the results were within the last month, but again, the analysts downgraded the EPS by 10% for the next 2 years. And there was no acknowledgement of that in the statement. That is a profits warning. So you can't, in my view, management need to be transparent and come out and talk about the reasons why they might be guiding to an earnings adjustment down 10% or thereabouts. And they're changing the year end. So all these things, I think, have left some shareholders going, you know, where's the credibility here? So, but it's still cheap. It's still quality earnings. And I do think that it's a business that should deserve a higher share price. But we need to get this management team being cognizant of the importance of delivering earnings and managing guidance. So, as you can imagine, those are conversations we're having.
Okay. They did talk about, I think, that their pledge book hadn't, they've had quite a lot of earlier redemptions on their pledge book, which says to me that maybe is that somebody else is funding the people who had obviously taken out those short-term loans to pay off that pledge book, which obviously would not be good, but that'd be total conjecture on my side.
Well, they used the reason that it was a high percentage of Asian gold, and it was at a time where there were there was quite a lot of celebrations going on, Asian celebrations going on. I didn't quite buy that, to be honest.
It must happen every year, that.
Tend to, but like Christmas comes around.
I know.
Saying that, Ramsden's also had some higher redemptions at that point, and it's maybe whether, I don't know.
Yeah,
what was getting pledged, maybe people feeling slightly better about life and we're pulling them out early. So, but that has stopped. So that was one of the reasons for the profits warning as well. Well, not that I'm allowed to call it a profits warning because apparently it wasn't.
Okay. All right. We've got one from, got a question coming in from Phil Curtis. He's basically saying, if you get a situation whereby there's an update, so actual fundamental information which comes out about it, it's hypothetical, that it's a positive update, so maybe they're upgrading, but the shares go down. How do you interpret that in terms of sort of like, you know, looking forward for the company? If it's basically a good update by the company, but the shares drop.
First thing I probably ask myself is, have I missed something? So get straight on the phone to the company just to reassure myself, because, you know, hopefully we know what the fundamentals are and why we've invested in something. So if that's still intact, then we buy shares on days like that. That's, you can make really good returns. And I think, you know, going back to the conversation at the start, you've seen that feature quite a lot over the last 2 months. Yeah. So it's a great buying opportunity. You've just got to be sure that you haven't missed something.
Yeah, it does tend to be a bit of a silly season, doesn't it, when you come to sort of earnings, because the market tends to sort of like that make a snap decision and then somebody for whatever reason decides to drop out and it shares the down, and then it can move quite rapidly the other way. Okay, we've got another one coming in from Ben Sharma, just asking about what sort of the key flags for a value trap share. What you sort of like, how do you distinguish between a value play and a value trap?
There's probably quite a few warning signs. One might be a kind of a management team that are not engaged and are maybe a bit kind of set in their ways, probably get paid a little bit too much. Because when the great thing with value traps is if you've got that catalyst, going back to what I said at the start, if you've got that catalyst, then you can get them to come out of it. But they've got to be prepared to maybe be a little bit more front-facing. They might be have to be prepared to look at M&A or selling off a division. So if you've got a management team or a board that are pretty much shut to ideas, then that's a big warning sign as well. And then industries that can be kind of low margin and, you know, at certain times might throw off a bit of cash. But, you know, if you look at it through maybe various cycles, have, you know, real peaks and troughs, they can be value traps as well, because you might just be catching it at a time that looks really cheap and it's throwing off cash. But you look back 5 or 6 years, it might have gone from 5 or 6% margins to 1% margin. So it's really just trying to understand the dynamics of companies through cycles.
Yeah. And also whether there's a secular tailwind behind the industry or whether there's not. If there isn't, it's into a headwind, then you might have great management team, but it may reduce the rate of decline, but it's going down.
Exactly.
We'll have plenty of those.
Yep.
Okay, good. Let's go to another stock. You've got Facilities of ADF, which basically is a rental business for sort of like trailers and outside production equipment for the sort of film and TV industry. Struggled a bit like the whole industry did with the Hollywood strikes last year. That seems to be coming back, but not quite according to Videndum yesterday, which is a camera business, professional camera business, and for Zoo Digital, which does sort of like dubbing for this industry as well. It seems as though it is returning. We're getting more productions out in the field and in the movie industry, but not quite as fast as people expect. Anyway, what's your latest on the Facilities of ADF?
Yeah, this is one that we just bought into, actually. So one of the cheaper ones in the portfolio, 6.5 times. I think we've only had it in the portfolio for about 2 months. And recently had the results out, but they were quite well flagged anyway, as you say, reflecting the writer's strike in the US. So they bought a business called AutoTrack, and that's they provide outdoor flooring, and they own all of their kit, so they're not leasing it. And so what you're seeing is the revenue going from 48 to about 67 million this year, and EBITDA going from 5.2 to 11 next year, just on the back of pulling in this acquisition. It's a really strange sector. When we started looking at it at first, there's about three or four providers in this space. Mm. And, you know, what they're doing is they're providing these massive trailers for makeup, for kind of resting vehicles for Brad Pitt or whoever. So there's a real ego within the industry as to what size your truck is.
And yes, you're right, Tom Cruise. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah, exactly. You know, he's got to have the biggest truck. And I hadn't quite realised that. So the fleet was quite important. The quality of the fleet is quite important. So they've got 700 premium units that can go anywhere. And, you know, what's the USP here? I didn't think there was one at first, but one is the knowledge of the industry, and they're selling into the production planner really for these big broadcasts, and it's all to do with relationships, very incestuous. So it's the relationships, it's also facilities management, it's being able to move stuff about the country. And what they'll say is that they might start filming Peaky Blinders in Wales. Is it Birmingham?
It's Birmingham.
In Birmingham. But they'd end up going to Cardiff like overnight because they need a quarry or something, or, you know, just something stupid like that. So they have their core contracts, and then they've got their overages, which can amount to another 60% on the contracts. They disclose this in the accounts, actually. So, you can get quite nice margins coming from those overages. As I say, another four operators in the space all got their own little niches. And here, what we are going to see, I think, well, you're going to get that earnings progression coming through, and you're not overpaying for it at the moment. But the real catalyst here is the cash flow inflection with AutoTrack coming on board. Because they own all their own kit and don't lease it, you're going to have a really nice cash flow kicker coming through the course of this next year. So, let's wait and see.
Auto tracks the portable roadways, isn't it? Just bought them. It's made that big acquisition. Looks a well run business. Okay, good. We've got a question coming from SC81. Any thoughts? And it was, I think, may you still hold it, is Flowtech Fluid Power, which came out with a profit warning, I think, yesterday. They've been going through a turnaround for some time. It did assume as though, I think there was some down trading in, and also there was some. I think some larger orders in the construction area are getting pushed to the right.
Yeah, that was disappointing. I mean, we've kind of known that that turnaround is probably going to take a wee bit longer than we thought. Mm. I'm catching up with them next week, or we are catching up with them next week, should I say. And we'll probably get a better idea as to really what the fundamentals there are. I think what we want to be looking at is, do they have the niche position that we think they have? And just to remind folk that, this is almost like an Amazon for the industrial space. Mm. And some of these products, there's lots of SKUs. Some of them are relatively sort of low margin, and there's a massive catalogue. And the whole point is that you're taking it from catalogue into online. And we just want to really test our assumption on the quality of the earnings here. We can understand some of the macro headwinds, but we'd hope that some of the self-help mechanisms would have kicked in by now. So that's still a few question marks on our book as well.
Okay, good. I mean, another one, another company which has done quite a large acquisition just recently is Kitwave, which is basically a UK wholesaler, distributor of food and products to convenience stores, but also to sort of like restaurants and other sort of and food service businesses, et cetera. Doing a buy and build strategy, and it raised, I think, quite a big amount of money just recently, which seems to be well received. How are you viewing Kitwave going forward?
Yeah, so they bought Creed Catering for about $60 million initially, and they raised 31 at 305, and I think the share price today is 340 odd. So it's been well received by the market. So if you go back to the start of the year, I think there was a concern really over some headwinds just in this space, in the food services space, and there had been a bit of a fear of their ability to get to the half two. Did have a lot to do to deliver there, but actually they come out pretty strong. So the earnings have improved there. And what's the idea here? I think this food services division is higher margin, strategically solid. They're now really going to be the kind of number two player here, number one, number two player, depending on what segment of the market you're looking at. And food services is now 60% of revenue. So I heard somebody saying the other day, it's not quite a mini booker, but there's some of the same dynamics here. They've got quite a strong market demand. They are servicing that convenience store market. Some of the headlines this week, actually, I don't know if you saw them, that there was a report out that said that convenience stores are charging 30% more than you'd pay there. So I was a bit worried about that. We don't want to see our convenience store disappearing or under pressure. It's an accretive acquisition, probably 5% accretion, and I don't think they're overpaying for it. It's on about 6x EV EBITDA that they paid for it. Mm. So, and target price, I think, is now in the range of about 430 or thereabouts. So, I think a good, solid business that has now gained market share in one of its key divisions that's higher margin. So we'll see how that integration gets on.
Yeah. I didn't think it was a massively sort of like earth-shattering headline, because I've always paid more down the convenience store than having a big mega store. It's obvious, isn't it? It's convenience, isn't it? You're paying for that. Smaller batches. Okay, let's finish on. We've got one which has obviously done quite well recently, CCTV or surveillance business, Synetics, which I think you've probably owned for quite some time. Shares have done pretty well of late. They service things like the transport sector, but also the casinos, which obviously had a bit of a sort of like turn benefit after the pandemic. How are you viewing this one? Because the shares still seem to be pretty good, but reasonably valued still.
Yeah, we had a nice bounce up in the share price. In November last year, Bob Holt, ex-Mears, we put him in his chair. One of the issues that we had with this business, really, really nice business that has got a great market position, but it had always kind of tripped up a little bit when it came to managing expectations. And so we were really keen to address that, because we could see potentially that the casino side of the business was going to come back online. Obviously, Asian casinos just fell off a cliff during COVID, and it took far, far longer for them to come back online. They've been benefiting from infrastructure spend in monitoring gas pipelines. So we've had some really good, strong contracts coming through there as well. And they took quite a lot of cost out of the business a couple of years ago. So you could see that the operational gearing would really start to kick through when we thought the growth returned. And that's really what's happened here. So we've got a return on capital about 10%, free cash flow yield, I think double digit now as well, but it's still in a single digit PE. Good quality business. Unfortunately, the CEO died very, very suddenly just a few weeks ago, which is just exceptionally sad. But fortunately, Amanda, the CFO, who's been in the business for years, has stepped up and she's got a good handle of things. So there's a good dream team with Bob Holt and Amanda now at the helm. We're very positive on this business. If you look at the incentive that shareholders, and we're a major shareholder here, put in for Bob, they don't kick in until over £3.10. And they only start kicking in at that point. So you know, we are really thinking about £4 and above for base valuation here. And I think we're going to get some more earnings momentum coming through, some great contract wins. And £4 million in cash, about 20% of his market cap in cash.
I mean, only 13.5 times PE. So, what's not to like? Difficult question to finish on, Judith, just in terms of, out of all the shares you own, what's the one which really excites you most, which you look forward to, which you think has got the greatest potential?
That's not fair.
I knew it wasn't, but...
all of these. Actually, I really like Synectics. It's a good one to end on. It's maybe because I've owned it for quite a while. And I feel reassured with the cash in the balance sheet, Bob Holt being there. And it's a business that's got really nice tailwinds from a sector point of view, and it's cheap. Yeah. So,
and any ones you've been selling of late, or is it just really you've been sort of profit taking, top slicing, and resizing the portfolio?
Yeah, nothing. I think the last thing we probably sold was we did sell out of Zoo Digital. We had a bit of exposure there. We came out of it quite quick, went in and came out quite quickly. And EKF as well, the one that we've already talked about for the reason. But we keep an eye on both of them. We think they're good businesses. Just not the timing right for us.
Good. Okay, fantastic. Well, thanks again for all your time. And just a couple of last messages then for sort of like investors over in small cap land for the next 12 months. Optimism?
Yeah, I'm feeling optimistic today. You know, just cantering through the portfolio like this, you realise the quality that you've got, don't you? And so, I'm feeling optimistic, hopeful that Rachel Reeves does the right thing and isn't stupid about the upcoming budget. But I do think that, you know, if that happens, if BR reliefs are left alone and these companies get a chance to shine in the way that they should do, then the market is going to be in a much better position in 12 months' time. So, buy for stock last.
Yeah, well, the 31st of October hopefully will be a good time for investors in small cap land when they realise that actually most of the zealous measures have been taken away. So thanks again, Judith, and look forward in touching base again in about 6 months' time.
Will do. See you soon.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.